Before we begin, I just want very quickly to introduce you to a podcast we're all loving here at the We Society. The Conversation Weekly is a show connecting new research to the biggest trends, ideas, and issues of today. Each week, hosts Dan Marino and Gemma Ware from The Conversation talk to some of the smartest people in the world to explore questions such as, how can we depolarize deeply divided societies? What happens next after stolen artifacts are returned to Africa? And could celibacy actually give some people an evolutionary advantage? Follow The Conversation Weekly for new episodes every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. Education, education, education has passed into the political lexicon as one of the more famous and telling political slogans. It captures everything, from the quote on the back of a £10 note from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, "I declare, after all, there is no enjoyment like reading," and of course there's no reading without education, to the need for life and work skills. Spending on education per head by the next election in real terms will not have risen at all for 14 years, a stunning indication of our national priorities, even though we know that in the 21st century the quality of our human capital is going to be our most important asset. We invest in and protect our pensioners, but not their grandchildren. 9,000,031 of them are at school at the moment. All the evidence is that education in especially early years has massive payoffs, in particular for kids from disadvantaged homes. But nursery provision is among the most expensive in the world, and where our five-year-olds get to go to school is a postcode lottery. If disadvantaged kids are 4 months behind in their early years, the gap has widened to 18 months by GCSE. With me to discuss all this is Professor Becky Francis, CEO of the Education Endowment Foundation, and one of the most passionate and expert analysts of what we're doing and what we need to do. Delighted to have you with us, Becky.
Thank you, Will.
When you got the email, the call saying, join me on the We Society podcast, what was your thought about We Society? What was your immediate thought?
Well, I suppose that education is an integral part of our social architecture. And of course, education is really the key collective means that in society we publicly contribute to socialising the next generation. So what could be more important? And for me as a passionate educationalist, I was very keen to take part.
But before we plunge into the kind of detail of this, how you see the system as a whole working, which parts are doing okay or well, and which ones are doing less well or badly, just, you know, just get a sense of this passion of yours. I mean, it's not obvious you have to be passionate working for the Education Endowment kind of foundation. It's not obvious you have to give your life to it. Why?
Well, I think I attended then an underperforming state school, state comprehensive, as a middle class child. And what I realised was that I progressed on, managed to scrape the qualifications that I needed to get into tech college and go to the next stage in a way that most of my friends didn't. And that had quite a profound impact on me. I've always then been interested in education and inequality, and that's really shaped my career. And of course, is the key mission of the EEF to try to break that link between social background, family income, and educational attainment. And of course, educational attainment still is the key predictor, the number one predictor for future life chances. But it is very intimately tied in this country to family wealth. So trying to work to mitigate that, and particularly to empower schools via the use of evidence-led practice, really seems to me to be both absolutely sort of central to what we should be trying to do, but never the more important in the present social conditions as well and the fiscal climate. So that's really what's brought me to the work.
And of course, this education attainment gap, I mean, kids from disadvantaged backgrounds, are kind of, as I said in the introduction, I mean, they're kind of 4 months, 5 months behind their peers, and that widens So when they're 15 or 16, you're talking 18 months. And it's stubborn, and it sits there, and it widens as they grow older. And you're right. I mean, you know, it's the best predictor of not just your income, but actually, you know, how happy you're going to be as an adult and how well you're going to live your life. I mean, it's such a fundamental thing. Do you think we cherish it enough in the UK?
I think that probably compared to some of our international comparators, you know, the short answer might be no. And the points that you made at the beginning about investing in the young were very well made, I think. There's also the long-standing conversation about the prestige in which the profession is held in this country, and that we could be doing more to support teachers and their ongoing professionalisation. But I think the key point that I would want to pick up is the one that you mentioned about the early years. We're clearly an outlier in our early years provision, both around...
In a bad way.
Both in terms of the kind of consistency of the offer or inconsistency of the offer. The fact that the most disadvantaged families often receive either the poorest support or can only access the poorest support, and the quality and the qualifications that we expect of early years professionals. That's a sort of very long-standing problem.
We just don't put resource into it. We just don't. I mean, I've got two grandchildren, you know, actually a third in the States. And you look at these, you know, wonderful kids. And of course, you know, as a grandparent, I want to, you know, I'll help my daughter as much as I can to make sure that these little boys, you know, get the best, you know. But it's such a postcode lottery, such a patchwork quilt. And childcare is so expensive. And, you know, and yet that's the future. You know, you can't, it's not just my grandchildren, it's the country's grandchildren.
And as you've already pointed out, Will, you know, the evidence is pretty strong that the earlier we invest, the more chance we'll have to close that gap with which kids arrive, even in the early years sector, and which, unless we address it early on, carries on growing as kids progress through the education system, which is indeed the case at present. So we know the evidence is very clear about the benefits of early intervention, but we're not doing that sufficiently in this country.
So if I made you education secretary with plenipotentiary powers, what would your first action be in this area?
I mean, of course, it depends how much money I had, Will. But I'll put that aside for the moment. It would probably be focusing on, again, professionalisation, looking
at... When you say professionalisation, you mean you want to get the men and women who are actually standing in front of our 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds of the highest possible standard.
Exactly. And at least baseline qualified in maths and English and so forth, which, of course, you know, isn't necessarily the case at present.
Seriously people teaching our young got the basic maths and English skills?
Well, you know, we have a situation where you might have one qualified professional and then a whole range of different assistants and so forth in every early years setting. And we mustn't forget, you know, that those carers are very poorly paid. So, of course, we can only expect...
Essentially, it's minimum wage, living wage, isn't it?
Exactly. So we can only expect those colleagues to be qualified and so forth, you know, in relation to the wages that they're paid.
It's such a stark contrast with Asian countries, you know, Singapore, you know, Malaysia, Japan, I mean...
And the Scandinavian countries. And quite a lot of European countries.
Why can't we get this sorted?
I mean, I imagine that some of it is because this has been existing for a very long time. So you're almost, you know, what we're starting with would take a huge amount of investment to address. And of course, we've been living in sort of fiscally challenging circumstances for many, many years now. That's challenging, but I do think there are many things that we can be doing in the interim. One of the things that I'm very proud of at the EF is the work that we're now doing focused on early years. It's actually quite a challenging area for research because it is so diverse, and that has meant that in the past the EEF has tended to focus on early years provision in schools, so reception classes and nursery classes that are provided in schools, because we can reach them through our amazing networks through the school system. What we're trying to do now is go beyond that. Through our re-endowment, we're actually mandated to start at age two, whereas we used to be age three. So that's an opening for us to start earlier. But it does mean that we are trying to address childminders, the private sector, as well as the public sector and so forth, and trying to, you know, grow our networks in that space is quite challenging. Nevertheless, the resources that the team are already putting together to support, again, early years professionals with evidence-led approaches that are going to be most effective with young children. I'm very proud of that work that we're doing.
When you say evidence-led, you mean, you know, so if you're standing with, you know, kind of 5 or 6 4-year-olds in front of you, you need to know what best to do during the course of a teaching day to get information over to them. How much is play? How much is play with a purpose, etc., etc.?
Exactly. Techniques for developing early
cognitive
language
skills, etc.
Yeah.
Got it. To what extent COVID throw all this out, even made it even worse?
Well, absolutely, profoundly, and particularly for young children, actually. But of course, it's affected kids right through the system, and we're seeing that at every level now. We can see right across the board from the early years foundation stage, then we've now had the results, you know, Key Stage 1, Key Stage 2, GCSEs, the modelling now for A levels as well. In each of these levels, we see that there's been a detrimental impact on attainment across the board, but also that's been particularly the case for kids and families from socially disadvantaged backgrounds. So the ongoing gap has actually widened as results have dropped overall. We're now beginning to see some catch up and bounce back, but generally that has been, again, sharper and more beneficial for more socially advantaged kids. And it tends to be that what we're seeing is the gap not closing. So although we're seeing some recovery, those gaps for social disadvantage are remaining, sadly, wider than they were before the pandemic. We've just added our own evidence to this wealth of evidence that's now growing. We're curating a longitudinal study that's commissioned from NFER.
NFER is an acronym that stands for?
National Foundation for Education Research. got it off pat, I think. they've been running a study of 6,000 young children for us who were in reception in March 2020 when the pandemic broke, and looking at their progress over time. And looking at their year threes, they're finding a gap of 9 months progress for reading now and 8 months for maths. And for the year twos, it's 6 months for reading and 5 months for maths. So you can see that really profound impact of the pandemic. And I guess
those are months they're behind, nine months and 8 months and 5 and 6 months, yeah?
Exactly.
Blimey, that's a lot of months. There was a big row, wasn't there? I mean, just with educationists saying, tell the government we need to spend north of $10 billion on this, and the government turning around and saying you can't have 10, you can have 2. Your view on all of that?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. There was a row about the recovery spending, and certainly compared to some of our competitor countries, you know, the Netherlands or the United States, notably, I think what we contributed was much lower. And everything that you've said, Will, about education recovery for the young and investment in the young, I think that, of course, we could have done with more. Nevertheless, one of the things
You're not really saying you want more. You want you know, you want the collective, you want society to kind of recognize, you know, the depth of damage that's been done to these young people, and actually to act to redress it on a similar scale to the way other countries are doing it. It's not more, it's actually what's right.
Absolutely. Having been involved in some of the sort of large scale sort of nationalisation interventions that took place during the pandemic, notably the National Tutoring Programme, but also less well known, but actually with further reach, the scale up of the Nuffield Early Language Intervention, looking at struggling learners in language in the early years. Spending money well quickly in times of crisis is actually really challenging.
Yep.
I think that's been one of my main takeaways from the pandemic, because of course capacity across the system was really low as well, as people were literally facing crisis.
Yeah.
Having to do extra stuff and having to plan in and facilitate additional things was really challenging. I feel like, you know, I learned a lot personally through those processes, and I think we've learned as a sector as well.
Just a quick break in the conversation to talk to you very briefly about the organisation behind the We Society. The Academy of Social Sciences is a national body for academics, practitioners and learned societies in the social sciences. As the president of the Academy, I can tell you that we champion the vital role social sciences play in education, in government, in business, the list goes on. From listening to the podcast, you'll hear that social scientists are at the forefront of tackling the most pressing issues of our time, from the cost of living crisis to the war in Ukraine, in every public or private sector strategy room in London, Edinburgh, Cardiff or Belfast, you'll find a social scientist. You can find out more about the Academy of Social Sciences work, support us or read up on our fellows by going to the website acss.org.uk. That's acss.org.uk. You can follow us on Twitter at @acadsocsciences and tell us what we should be covering, who we should be speaking to, by emailing wesociety@acss.org.uk. Now, back to the conversation.
When we think about recovery broadly, you know, it's become quite a trite thing to say, but the whole Build Back Better idea, I think, is really important that we actually take that opportunity. And till very recently, schools have been gravely worried about their financial situation, absolutely exacerbated by the growth of poverty that we've seen through the pandemic and then through the cost of living crisis, and the impact on, you know, of fuel costs and so on schools themselves.
Yeah.
So all of that was making schools very worried and very unhappy places. We've now had the budget and the commitment of that extra funding for schools, which I think was a huge relief for school leaders. Which allows them then to be sort of planning for the future and in a little bit of a less of a situation of crisis. And that's, I think, been very, very welcome. So it allows us to think a little bit more about what we would want to achieve. You know, the key ongoing challenge for the English education system, certainly, is its patchiness. That's a really long-standing problem. You know, we've got some of the best provision in the world, but also provision that is, you know, frankly embarrassing in a developed country. So we really have both ends of the spectrum, and we need to alleviate that. We need, as I've already talked about, to address the early years, and that's actually pivotal in facilitating life chances, but setting kids up well for their educational futures as well as their long-term futures. Poverty and social inequality more broadly, of course, impacts all of this. We know about the gap that kids bring into their school lives, which, you know, then schools are firefighting rather than having everybody at equal starting points. And all of this, you know, needs to be addressed and taken in the round. So there's a very well-known mantra, you know, schools can't make the difference, but they can make a difference. So we have to recognise, you know, what is brought to schools' doorsteps and that they can't fix all social problems. But we also need to be optimistic and have high aspiration about what schools can do in terms of their focus on high quality teaching and learning. In relation to the point about recovery, we have collated what we hope is a really good digest of what the evidence says will stand schools in good stead in using their resources to support both socially disadvantaged students, but also recovery and that gap closure. And of course, as I've said, you know, that value for money at present is really important too. So we talk about a tiered approach to spending the pupil premium, the key resource focused on socially disadvantaged pupils.
And this premium, I mean, this was introduced by the coalition government, it still exists, doesn't it? But essentially, just so people know what it is. I mean, it's an amount over and above what a school would expect to get, depending on a kind of matrix of disadvantage indicators, you know. So if you've got above average numbers of kids on school, free school meals, whatever it is, you know, that will qualify you to get additional resource, yes?
Exactly. It's quite radical because it's redistributive. You know, the money does actually follow each child that generates.
And do we think it's to make a difference? I mean, you're an advocate of it, aren't you?
Yes, absolutely. Very, very strong advocate, and I think we have quite good evidence that it has a positive impact. Stephen Gorard and other social scientists have analysed this at length, and we've got good evidence as well that schools are gradually moving to a kind of evidence-led approach to the pupil premium. And again, the EEF is very gratified that you know, a very large proportion of schools now make reference to our resources in the statement that they have to publish on their website.
When you say your resources, you mean the advice you give. You don't mean financial
not
resources.
Not financial resources, thank you. Both advice we give, but also the materials that we supply to support this, including this guidance report.
If you're a teacher listening to this or a parent listening to this, I mean, can you go on the websites and see the resources? It's all available, isn't it?
Absolutely. We've got our famous teaching and learning toolkit that distills a collection of over 3,000 of the most robust education research in the world and distills it down into sort of 35 different topic areas. In each case, we have a very simple badging system where we designate, there's a little icon that shows the amount of months progress, or of course it could be lack of progress, depending on what the
progress.
Evidence says, exactly, delivered by that approach if done well. The number of pound signs indicates how expensive or otherwise the approach is, and then the number of padlocks indicates the security or otherwise of the evidence that underpins the approach. And then for those that are interested, you can drill into the toolkit and find out much more nuanced information and so forth about effective practice. So that's been a key resource for us for years, and it's freely available and people can look at that. But we also have lots and lots of different templates, resources, toolkits and so forth that are built around it to help teachers bring the evidence to life, exemplify it for their classrooms and so on. And in relation to the point about recovery, I think one thing that tends often to be forgotten, Will, as we think about, you know, different interventions and so forth, actually, the research is really clear that it's high quality teaching that makes the best impact on pupil progress, and that's particularly true for socially disadvantaged pupils. And so actually investing in high quality teaching and the development of existing teachers, building their expertise, even spending money to help recruit and retain good teachers is a really valid and important way of spending your pupil premium, ensuring, of course, that those teachers that you develop and retain are actually teaching socially disadvantaged kids.
Yes, salaries for teachers in real terms have slid, haven't they? I mean, in many respects, being a teacher is kind of, you know, one of the most important things you can do. I mean, I It's fascinating. You know, every day you get to work, you know what your purpose is, and purpose drives satisfaction. And yet, we've got this crisis of kind of, you know, teachers suffering from mental health, teachers wanting to leave the profession. I'm sure some teachers listening to this will actually want us to come down from our kind of cloud nine and say, you know, get your hands dirty with me and, you know, my classroom, and the kids are actually in front of me. I mean, the lived reality of teaching is nothing like so inspiring. You know, actually, I'm just fighting to keep order in the class, actually.
For sure. And as I've said already, you know, the conditions in which teachers are having to operate at the moment, first through those exhausting periods of the pandemic where teachers really became the sort of fourth emergency service and really were responding. I mean, literally often providing meals and so forth for families struggling in the pandemic. But also you remember keeping the schools open for key workers, children and socially disadvantaged students and so forth, even when things felt very dangerous with the pandemic. So it really has been a tough time, but teachers have absolutely shown, you know, their worth and commitment. And I think the public really recognised that during the pandemic, actually. You know, there was a real wave of gratitude, particularly, of course, for all of those parents who were having to home educate. Yeah, I think that really woke many of us up to, you know, how difficult a teacher's job is day to day. The conditions that I've described, you know, where we have this sort of mental health crisis, cost of living is pushing more families into poverty and so forth, and the onus and expectation on teaching and school staff to be, you know, really feeding and clothing children.
What about the national curriculum? I mean, is it stretching enough? Is it? I mean, does it box people in too much? I mean, does it not permit, you know, teachers to kind of really stretch themselves in their pedagogical skills? I mean, what's your view of the national curriculum?
Well, I'm a big fan of the national curriculum, Will. It was really, I can remember being a doctoral student at the time that the national curriculum was just being first implemented, and it was hugely controversial at the time. But actually, very quickly, we started to see its impact, for example, on narrowing gender gaps with girls improving their outcomes in maths and in STEM particularly. And we began to see the impact in terms of access, with young people being able to move school and not finding that, you know, you were going from learning one thing in one place to something completely different somewhere else. You know, that consistency, which is really important in terms of access to a high quality, broad and balanced curriculum. And I was one of those who, you know, when we first had the Academies programme being accelerated just over a decade ago, there was a, you know, that one of the supposed appeals of academisation was that you could be freed from the national curriculum. Actually, that didn't happen in practice, certainly not very often. Often it's said that that's because of the power of Ofsted as a sort of, and the different accountability measures that were, mitigating against innovation. Actually, I felt that it was often the greatest examples of innovation were where kids were most badly let down. So I think that, having a broad and balanced curriculum entitlement is really a sort of fundamental right. And it's good that when, you know, we publicly invest in education, that can be committed for every child. There are downsides, I do recognise. And of course, the ongoing cut and thrust of, you know, which subjects are represented and to what extent the ongoing question, is it too, you know, are we particularly focused on different subject areas and so forth? All of that will continue on. But as a basis, I think that it's fundamental that we have a national curriculum. And although, of course, there always improvement can be made, nevertheless, I think it's pretty good at the moment.
We're getting near the end now, but I don't think we can really, you know, discussion about the British education system not touch on the strength, extraordinary strength, of the British private school system within that. I mean, it's the largest, it's even larger than the American private school system, and even larger than some countries which have religious schools as private. And it's quite a thing. I mean, it educates 7% of our pupils, and many more, a fifth of our A-level students. I mean, it's a stunning kind of fact. They probably shouldn't have charitable status. Equally, you know, people have choice, so you have to respect that. But it is a form of kind of bottom-up social engineering, is it not? I mean,
yes. I mean, it always surprises me, this debate about university access that we've seen raising its head again recently, and, you know, parents and schools who are, you know, funding pupils 3 or 4 times, is it now, more well than a state-educated pupil, complaining that there's social engineering involved in university admissions processes. it does seem incredible. And, of course, given that most private schools select both in terms of wealth, because you've got to be able to afford it, and the costs have, as we know, proportionally risen, but also on the basis of prior attainment, that is, of course, you know, creaming
yes, you've
away
got already advantaged from the... already advantaged children, be more advantaged, and some of the resources in these private schools are just kind of, you know, it's like they're like Triffids, you know, they're just, you know, you don't need to put 16, 17, 18-year-olds through laboratories that you know, are equal to the Rutherford in Cambridge or some such. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, they're not, it's an overinvestment, and the scale of the number of playing fields at Eton has gotten out of hand. And, you know, it's just absurd. I mean, one needs to kind of come back to earth and say, it's too much. And actually, they themselves should open themselves up more than they do.
Yeah, I think obviously there have been efforts in that direction over the years.
They failed.
Yeah, and of course, academisation was another example of that, where there was, I think, great government hope that public and private schools, you know, would join with state schools, both in sponsorship but in terms of
stead. Selden was a big advocate of that. Really tried to make it work, and just bounced off was the resistance by parents.
Yeah, and I think that there was also, you know, some, maybe there was a bit of a wake-up call during that process as well, because, of course, some private schools with good, you know, genuinely good intentions did try to engage sponsorship that it was much harder than they'd expected get good results. So I think that was probably a bit of a learning curve, and maybe that put off others. But certainly, as you say, well, it wasn't very successful in terms of outcomes and engagement. And I suppose that, again, with this, you know, Labour Party policy of...
withdrawing the charitable status.
Exactly. Perhaps that will be an incentive for.
Well, it's a small step towards leveling the playing field. I mean, in the round, I mean, here we are. We've been discussing this now for 40 minutes or thereabouts. I mean, it is a curate's egg, isn't it? I mean, it's good in parts, but we've talked about some of the evidence base that you provide. I mean, that's all to the good. And then we've got this other side of the coin, which is all this. And actually, internationally, you know, our scores are okay. And actually, internationally, education attainment hasn't gone backwards, curiously, in this period of static real spending per head. It's kind of more or less stayed the same. So maybe things are going right somewhere in the system. On the other hand, you know, there's this tremendous sense an enormous number of kids, I mean, the two-fifths that don't get the kind of A star to C they need at GCSE, as it used to be described, I mean, and then what? And then what happens to them afterwards? And then actually, you know, the alphabet soup of our kind of training system and the desperate poverty of the FE world, the further education world. I don't know where should we leave our listeners at the end of this podcast? Should they be optimistic? Should they be recognise what's been achieved and say more to be done? Come on, you've got
well,
finish that. Finish. You know, give us the resounding. Give us the finale. We're going to the grand finale.
I think it's right that we we focus on what's going well, and we've got main challenges coming out of recovery, including as we've been discussing the gap for socioeconomic background and attainment, which we must continue to retain our focus on. So that's urgent, that we continue the focus on the gap and recovery. But I think you're also right. There's a common debate in education circles in the UK around what's commonly phrased sort of 21st century skills and learning. I mean, actually, I think in contrast to that, we're doing pretty well and can show good evidence for most of our pupils in terms of that kind of educational progress based on strong foundations. Where I think we do need more attention is for our low attainers. That large proportion of kids who don't get their four and above at GCSE, and particularly in maths and English. And I think for those young people in England, there's relatively little for them. We had the situation where they were expected to retake their GCSEs multiple times. That was shown to be an ever-decreasing return for them.
One of my children went through all of that, yeah.
But of course, with the right direction, because we've talked already about the power of and the impact of those GCSE outcomes for future life chances. So I understand where that impetus came from, but it wasn't fruitful as an approach. So what we do need to think, I think, for those young people is about their foundation qualifications that are meaningful for employers and that really do set them up for their futures, and to be able to provide them further access to learning as well. That, I think, would be my takeaway.
Becky Francis, Professor Francis, thank you so much. You've been an illuminating interviewee, a discussant, member of the kind of We Society podcast alumni now. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Will.
And over the last kind of 40 minutes, you've given us a really, really a cook's tour. You discussed COVID, you discussed low attainment, you discussed the importance of early years. We've had a review of the importance of the British private school system. You've given a tick-ish to academies, and a big tick to the national curricula. And at the end there, you told us what you do. Thank you so much. It's been illuminating and enjoyable. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Will.
Thank you so much for joining in the conversation. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton. The producer is Emily Finch. And it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends, or send us an email and tell us what we should be asking and who we should talk to. If you're interested in exploring the social sciences from a bit of a different perspective and a touch of humour, we recommend you check out The Social Breakdown, a podcast created by University of Hawaii sociologists Penn, Omar and Ellen, who use their sociological imagination to make sense of our complex world, one topic at a time. The Social Breakdown team, along with the occasional guest, examine a wide range of topics, from love and dyads to the internet and media, from conformity and obedience to social institutions. They tackle it all. They also have several episodes on the processes of academia, a PhD's guide to getting a PhD and existing in a world of fellow PhD's, if you will. You can find the Social Breakdown's catalogue of over 100 episodes on their website, thesocialbreakdown.com, and listen to their show wherever you get your podcasts.